We'll be talking about the life of Henry Ford. And, of course, Henry Ford, it's well known that he pioneered mass production and by doing the assembly line made it possible for cars to be manufactured inexpensively enough. Previously, before Ford, they were really hand-built, sort of one-of-a-kind items, of course, and only wealthy people could afford them. But one of the things that Ford did was he made it possible for a lot of people to have cars, and of course that changed America in many different ways. This morning, though, we're going to focus on a different aspect of Ford's character and his life, something that I expect for a lot of people is really unknown. This will be very new to them. And that is the fact that Henry Ford did a great deal to foster anti-Semitism in this country, and perhaps also around the world. And our guest for the program this morning is Neil Baldwin. He's authored a newly published book on the subject. The title is Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. Public Affairs is the publisher on the book. Just a little bit more about our guest, Neil Baldwin. He's executive director of the National Book Foundation, and he is the author of a number of books, including biographies of the American artist Man Ray, the poet William Carlos Williams, and the inventor, Thomas Edison. And in fact, he explains in the book, Henry Ford and the Jews, that it was his work on Edison that opened this door onto the life of Henry Ford and led him into doing the work that ended up being this book. As we talk this morning with Neil Baldwin, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, join the conversation, 333-9455. We also do have that toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, another way to think about it is 333-WILL, and also toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Baldwin, hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Well, we appreciate it very much. And I was interested because we do, I don't know that I would expect you to remember, but we did indeed talk about Thomas Edison, your book about Edison. It was interesting to learn here that that was your first hints about Ford and his anti-Semitism really came as you were working on Edison.
So I was on your show.
Yes, we talked about the Edison biography.
So that would be 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, it's been some time.
Gosh, well, we've all gotten older and wiser, haven't we? Yep,
well,
I know you have.
Well, we've gotten older. I'm not sure about the other part.
So tell me, what's your first question?
But anyway, I was interested to learn indeed that your way into this was it was as a result sort of an unintended offshoot of the work on Edison. And I guess, in fact, someone had suggested to you then writing a biography of Ford, and by that time you had learned enough about him to think perhaps you didn't care much for the man, but that this was a topic that was worthy of special interest.
You know, it wasn't so much that I didn't care for him, because as a biographer, I've always tried, you know, to maintain a sense of being outside, I mean, very, very into the research, but outside the subject so that I can be as objective as possible. The problem was that after you do somebody like Edison, who was such a giant and such a genius in so many ways, I recognize and I say very overtly in the book that Henry Ford's contribution to the culture of the entire world is undeniable. The automobile, whether you are in favor of it or not, actually doesn't really matter if you're in favor of it or not. It's ubiquitous and it's there, and he was the person who consumerized the automobile and the internal combustion way of getting around, and so I think it's almost impossible to measure his impact. But what happened was I came across some diaries that were kept by John Burroughs, who was a naturalist who went on a camping trip with Edison and Ford and Harvey Firestone and several other people in the Adirondack Mountains. And in the evening, they were talking around the campfire, and this anti-Jewish rhetoric started spewing forth from Henry Ford's mouth. And this was like 1918 or 19. It was just during or just after the First World War. And John Burroughs kept notes on this conversation, and they were never published in his memoirs, but I came across them in the New York Public Library in the Berg Collection in New York, and that got me thinking. And then in the spring of 1997, the Ford Motor Company sponsored a commercial-free broadcast of Schindler's List on Channel 4, I believe it was. And the irony of that, coupled with what I had just read about and learned about Ford's beliefs, started me thinking maybe that's what I should write about.
Hmm. I was interested to learn that not only was Ford important because of the automobile and the changes that brought in America, or perhaps because of that, he was a significant individual in the sense that he was widely admired by Americans, and because of who he was, that gave him a platform from which to speak. And I actually, one of the things that I was interested and surprised to learn was that not only was he interested in politics, he was interested in politics at a high level. And in fact, in 1916, his name was placed in nomination at the Republican National Convention as a candidate for the presidency.
Yes, it's Henry Ford. He was and is an American icon, and that's what made it so problematic. And a lot of people said, they said to me at the beginning of this journey, why are you doing this? Why are you taking on such a complicated subject? Why don't you just let it lie? See, the book that I've written isn't just an ad hominem attack on Henry Ford and an exposure of his attitudes. I try to take a more nuanced approach to talk about, after he published his newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, where the major articles began to appear against the Jews, that was kind of like his first public platform, how did the American Jewish community, which in and of itself was such a splintered and fragmented group of people, how did they deal with this outpouring from such a prominent and, as you say, popular person? How did the leadership of the American Jewish community among themselves debate and write back and forth and write to Henry Ford and try to sponsor petitions and articles and editorials? And so I dug deeply into the Jewish archives all around the country. I would say I spent more time in the Jewish Theological Seminary and the American Jewish Congress and places like that than I did in the Ford archives. I just want to make it clear that it's a dialectical problem. It's an antagonism of two sides.
Sure, and also it another thing that the book does is it talks not just about Ford and his anti-Semitism, but anti-Semitism in America at the time. And knowing that, I guess one would have to acknowledge the fact that in his anti-Semitism, Henry Ford was not exceptional for his time.
No, as a matter of fact, it's a big topic, and I go even further than that. I decided I should try to place it not only in a context of America at the time, and Henry Ford's dates are 1863 to 1947, which is important to sort of put in the back of your mind, but I also decided to place it in the continuum of anti-Semitism from the time of the origins of the Jews to the present, to show that not only does he have a place in American culture, but he has a place in the entire ideological culture. See, the thing is that Henry Ford's beliefs, as you just said, were not unique to him. A person growing up in populist America after the Civil War, at a time when the huge influx of Eastern European immigration was coming to America, hundreds of thousands of the tired and poor and huddled masses, as they say, were coming to New York City and spreading out all across the country. These were people who were impoverished, persecuted. They didn't look like Americans. They didn't talk like Americans. They didn't dress like Americans. They weren't Protestants. They weren't white. They weren't, they didn't speak English. And yet they wanted a place in our country, and they wanted a place in our melting pot. And some people didn't like that. Henry Ford did not like that. At the most basic level, he felt that the Jews, because they were different, didn't belong here. They shouldn't be here. That's really how it sort of started.
Mm. Let me just real quick introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Neil Baldwin. He's the author of a number of books, several of them biographies, the American artist Man Ray, the inventor Tom Edison, and the poet William Carlos Williams. He's also co-editor of a collection of interviews with authors about their working lives, which is titled The Writing Life. And the book that we're talking about this morning is about Henry Ford. And the title is Henry Ford and the Jews. The subtitle is The Mass Production of Hate. It's published by Public Affairs. Is out now fairly recently in the bookstores, of course, if you want to look at it. And your questions, comments are welcome. 333-WILL toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the little ironies here, and perhaps this is the case often with prejudice, is it's based on not on any kind of personal experience, but a lot of secondhand information. One of the things you note in the book is the fact that in his youth, perhaps, there were only about 1,000 Jewish people living in Detroit, and that chances are pretty good that before he was an adult, Henry Ford never even met one.
Yes, and that is one of the things in building the case, just very briefly, when Henry Ford was in school, which would be like late 1860s into the late 1870s, as he was growing up as a young boy in Dearbornville, Michigan, a little farming town north of Detroit, his main reading matter was something called the McGuffey Readers, which were probably the most popular textbook in American schools in the 19th and early 20th century. I think about 125 million copies in various different printings were sold of that McGuffey Reader over like a 100-year period. And in that McGuffey Reader, you know, I grew up in the 50s and I read, you know, Fun with Dick and Jane, and I read, you know, about Sea Spot Run and things of that nature. I know that really dates me, but anyway. But Henry Ford, in the McGuffey Readers, he came across the first stereotypical stories about Jews. There were lots of little parables from a Christian standpoint about the Jewish money lenders, and there was a whole chapter on Shylock, the Merchant of Venice character from Shakespeare. And the fact of the matter is that at a very young age, Henry Ford was exposed to these cliched stereotypes, and these were very widespread and very much, as you say, accepted in American society during that period and going into the turn of the century, the populist movement in the South, you know, where the farmers were banding together and blaming the New York bankers, you know, / Jews, you know, for controlling the financial structure of America. So let's be sure we understand the context of his development, his ideological development.
Why, I guess one further question is why it was that he would decide to take these views from simply being views that were personally and strongly held to something that he wanted to
promulgate.
And, yeah. And in fact, to the point where one of the things you explain is that he liked the idea of having a big platform, from metaphorically speaking, a big platform from which to speak. He felt he had important things to say, and so in order to disseminate those views, he actually started his own newspaper, and you've mentioned it, the Dearborn Independent.
Right.
What was it that led him to feel that this was a message that was so important that he, in effect, wanted to broadcast it?
Well, I think that I've figured out when the tipping point was, and it was much, you know, he was a middle-aged guy. We're talking about, let's just put a few dates here. In 1908, the Model T Ford was first marketed. By 1911 or 12, 13, and thereabouts, Henry Ford was a millionaire. You have to understand the meteoric rise in wealth and prominence over that 4 or 5 year period in there. Then you get into then you have the shock of the war, World War One, and then you have Henry Ford's first public intimations that he's basically using the Jews as a scapegoat and blaming Jewish international quote Jewish bankers for causing World War One by infiltrating the economies of European countries and being the invisible wire pullers behind the armament of Europe. And that created a threat and a tremendous strain on Henry Ford's company. And what I try to show in the book is that, therefore, I feel his first, the first public manifestation was based upon an economic reaction he was having against the Jews. At the same time in this country, the Federal Reserve Bank was created in 1910 to 1912. And the idea for the Federal Reserve Bank came from Paul Warburg, who was a Jewish-German immigrant from the Warburg family in Germany, married into the Schiff family, which is a very powerful Jewish family here in America. So you get this you get this combination of Jewish power and money power, and then you put that up against the war and the effect of that on Henry Ford's corporate existence, and then you have a very potent brew of, you know, where you can develop a paranoid feeling. I'm speaking in terms of Henry Ford's feelings. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I position this. You know, rather than saying, well, I read a story about Shylock when I was 16 years old, that's, you know, like, I think it's important to bring that up, but millions of young kids in America read those same stories and they didn't end up doing what he did. It really had a, had effect on his pocketbook.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Other people, by the way, who are listening are certainly welcome. You have questions here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller. They're on a cell phone on line number one. Hello?
Yeah. I doubt you've read this book, but because there's no reason you would have. There's a book by fairly prominent economist, political scientist, and Gary Miller called Managerial Dilemmas. It has a long section on Henry Ford in there because Henry Ford ended up being sort of one of these, he's kind of the inventor of the industrial management. One of the interesting things about that is that I think you can see in his management style some real totalitarian tendencies, for lack of a better word, and I don't like to trot that word out lightly, but I can't really think of a better one. He had, and I think looking for the sort of the bottom line was probably the main motivation for this, but he did a number of really strange things, well, things that I think nowadays we would consider pretty disgusting. The Ford Sociology Department in Ford Motor Company would break families up, all sorts of things like this. One of his main motivations for paying his employees three times the market rate was that he could effectively discipline them. If they quit, they lost a huge amount of money, so they couldn't leave. But along with this came the bargain of the Ford Sociology Department, which would come into your house and see what you're doing, to see if you're sort of appropriate to work at Ford, things like that. In the 20s, he ran Ford Motor Company as a dictatorship. I don't know, fortunately, unfortunately, it is true. He ended up really screwing up. He built the Model T for a long, long time, long after it was actually completely obsolete. And in the end, other companies sort of took over. But he was an odd guy, a very odd guy, very, very opinionated. It's quite possible that decisions based on some decisions he made killed his son Edsel, because his son Edsel died of food poisoning from milk drank from the Ford dairy, which Henry Ford was adamantly opposed to pasteurization and any other sorts of health considerations for reasons no one knows. Things like that. So I think that the fact that he was anti-Semitic and he took it to the next level is not really too surprising, given that he took pretty much everything to the next level.
And these are all things that the author actually does deal with, talking about his management style, his tendency to want to take workers and mold them into the image that he had in mind, even the fact that all this was very hard on a lot of people, and including his son, and in indeed being Henry Ford's son might have been the thing that killed Edsel Ford.
So this is all in your this is all in Mr. Baldwin's book too.
Yeah. Well, I should give him a chance to respond. Yes.
I think it's so interesting. What was the name of that book you just mentioned?
Managerial Dilemmas.
Managerial Dilemmas. Well, this is this.
It's not otherwise about Ford. He just uses it.
Yes, but I think that's a terrific catchphrase because, and this was one of the big temptations I had, of course, having written about Edison. You know, somewhere toward the end of my Ford book, I sat back one day, I was at my desk, and I thought, gee, maybe I should have written a biography of Henry Ford because I became so wrapped up in his, as the caller is saying, his the consonance, the consistency between his the way he ran the company and the way he ran his ideology, even to the point of that's where we got the title The Mass Production of Hate, which I have to give my publisher, Peter Osnos, who's the CEO of Public Affairs, came up with that catchphrase because he pointed out to me that it seemed as if Ford's methodology of producing cars was very similar to his methodology of producing these articles in the Dearborn Independent week after week after week, kind of the same idea. There was this obsessive and compulsive need to be in control, and as the caller is saying, it carried over to the personal lives of his employees, but it also carried over to, I think, he felt that people like him, native-born American white males, frankly, were losing control of the country to the outsider, the alien. The Jew is such a symbol of the alien, of the outsider. It was almost like immigration touched a nerve in Ford that he never recovered from. I mean, the great wave of immigration, it was almost like he must have been sitting there in Dearborn, you know, waiting for the sort of tidal wave to engulf him. And so I think these things are interpenetrated and interconnected. I agree. I want to check out that book. I wrote it down, Managerial Dilemmas. So thank
you. Yeah, I mean, it's otherwise... I mean, well, it's got lots of really great examples of all sorts of things in it, but there's a long extended example on Henry Ford because Ford is so illustrative of he's kind of the inventor, or maybe the inventor is the wrong word. He's sort of the perfecter of the hierarchical business model.
But see, it, as I say, that mentality, and there's so many other managerial strategies that he used, which I talk about. If he had a meeting of the editorial board of the Dearborn Independent, which was basically him and two or three of his most trusted inner circle and a few other functionaries, and he very often would arrive late or leave early or get up in the middle of a conversation to keep people off balance. He would turn up at the factory. You know, like you'd be working, minding your own business, working on the assembly line, just, you know, doing your little job there. And all of a sudden, Henry Ford would materialize, like standing right behind you. He would pull you off the line and ask you how things are going. And, you know, he would come and go like a ghost, kind of. And if you take that behavior pattern and you just can apply that to sort of this kamikaze approach to publishing articles and books and pamphlets and disseminating them and sending them to people unsolicited, you know, turn up in your mailbox would be a little pamphlet called The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. If you were the head of a Rotary Club, he did a lot of direct mail of this stuff. He sent the anthologies of these articles to community leaders all across the country. He also sent them His dealership, the entire Ford dealership network all around the country also had to be subscription salesmen for the Dearborn Independent. They had to meet a quota every month of selling subscriptions to the magazine along with the cars. So, you know, it was very much central to his behavior.
We're a little bit past the midpoint. I have another caller I want to get to. And for anyone who has tuned in the last 5-10 minutes, I think I should again introduce our guest. We're speaking with Neil Baldwin, and he writes about this story here that we're talking about, the anti-Semitism of Henry Ford, in his new book. It's titled Henry Ford and the Jews. The subtitle is The Mass Production of Hate. It's published by Public Affairs. Did the, just real quick here, I want to ask, and I'll go on to a caller, did the Independent ever make money, or did it always lose money?
From what I can tell, and you have to just understand that in the Ford archives, the Henry Ford Museum archives in Dearborn, the museum archives, most of the material pertaining to the Independent, including drafts for articles and correspondence and financial records, have been removed or destroyed by the Ford Motor Company. This is a known fact. I'm not opening up some can of worms. I mean, this has been known for 20 or 30 years. So, but it's possible to reconstruct a sort of a financial pattern, and basically the Dearborn Independent was pretty much in the red all the time. Really, it was a big money. It was a hemorrhaging money operation, but he did it anyway because he felt he had to. Yeah.
Let's talk with another caller here. This is Champagne, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Interesting topic. I can imagine you're kind of in a firestorm because you are taking on an American icon, but I think it's important to discuss these things because I think the men primarily behind the Industrial Revolution were very often motivated people who have very complex personalities. I just had a comment and then a question. One, and I don't think this is unique to anti-Semitism, but the publication and then self-referencing of material against the perceived Jewish threat goes very far back to the Dreyfus Affair and this basically bogus publication about the banking conspiracy concerning the Elders of Zion, which is unfortunately still quoted by right-wingers.
Oh, yes, and that's, of course, Ford was the main publisher of that in this country. So.
Oh, he was. Okay. I was kind of wondering about that because... And
that's where we get it from. We get it thanks to the Dearborn Publishing Company, who did not copyright any of their screeds. You can still get the Protocols of the Elders of Zion anywhere.
And I think that is still not an uncommon tactic for people in whatever area to publish something bogus and then somebody else quotes it and gosh, you've got it in another book. And now we've got two bogus sources to quote. So I think he's following in a fine tradition that unfortunately we get from a number of European countries. And I don't, want to single out any European country because I think it's pretty much universal across Europe at the turn of the century. And, so I don't think you could, although I'd be interested to know, was there a seminal event in his life? Because very often people, point to a single incident where they say, this is why, did you find something like that, or was it just...
Well, I talked in the earlier part of the program about how I thought I had determined a tipping point in terms of the period of his life when he started to publicly articulate his views. And the interesting thing is he was in his late 40s before this happened. This was in my view, about 1912, 13, 14, somewhere in there. I was saying earlier that there was a confluence of profit, problems at the Ford Motor Company, combining with the start of World War One, combining with the huge wave of immigration, combining with the founding of the Federal Reserve System. These things all are within like a 2 to 3 year period of time. And then there's a lag where he tries to figure out a platform. Then he starts to talk about founding his own newspaper as early as 1916 and doesn't start publishing it till 1920. So it's a very long evolution, and in those years also is when he hired two people, Ernest Liebold and William Cameron, to work for him. And Ernest Liebold was of Prussian German birth. He was from Detroit. He was a rabid anti-Semite, and he was the person who reached out to the person, Boris Bresol, who brought the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to America. And William Cameron was a editorial writer from the Detroit News, who was a right-wing Christian, a British Israelite. And so, see, it's like putting your team together and then going out on the field when you're totally ready. That's how I, you know, was there one Jewish person that offended him or lent him money or something? I really don't think it was about that. It was about hitting him where he lived, as the first caller said. I believe that it was an economic matter, because every time there was a flurry of activity in the Jewish question, I show how it's connected to problems in the Ford Motor Company.
Mm-hmm.
It's like clockwork.
Well, it's scapegoating probably then, too.
Yeah, I'm just saying that here's the guy, he's a quintessential capitalist, and he's raging out against, you know, people who he considers to be the biggest threat to him as a quintessential American capitalist.
Well, and the Pullman strike and the Haymarket riot were during his early life.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, history, when you look back on things and you start to think that you're writing history, this is the first book I've written where I felt I could call myself a historian. It's very weird, because up until now I've thought of myself as being a, quote, biographer, unquote. But history, the sense of history is so difficult, because I believe that every generation, at least, there's a revision of so many things that have been received into our general knowledge. It's sort of, if you look back in 20-year chunks, I mean, look what's happening with FDR right now, how he's being not demonized but revised. There's just a tendency to revisit. You know, new archives are open. Look what happened with Charles Lindbergh. It's very common. I guess history is as DeVico, Jean-Baptiste DeVico, not to show off my knowledge, but I do remember the Italian philosopher Vico and his view of history as a giant wheel that just keeps turning, and I know that, and sort of spiraling forward.
Well,
so I don't want to get too far off this.
Right, and certainly historical figures have feet of clay and are presented with a variety of poor choices, and I'm not saying that excuses Ford, but I certainly think he's part of the populist movement. Lindbergh was another flaming fascist. But which brings me to my second point. I'm curious, because I know here in this part of the country, the Bundist Party, which people may not be aware of, was a German-American Nazi party. And I think people were desperately searching for reasons to say it wasn't Germany's fault that the war started. And I think a lot of people can take that perspective, that, you know, there's even been a book saying that victors always start the wars, and therefore Germany didn't even start World War II. But I think that probably pays, and I'm just curious about his connections with the Bundist Party, because it's pretty well established fact that Ford was connected with Nazi Germany. His factories remained unbombed and open during World War II. And so I'm curious where he played. Was he a neutralist? Was he, because there was a huge populist movement, especially.
Well, don't get me wrong. I just want to make a pitch for.
Yeah, and I'm just asking about that, the connection to maybe the American pacifist and the Bundist.
No, I mean, I was going to say, you really should go out and get the book. It's worth reading. But beyond that, no, I talk a lot about toward the end. I try to bring, you know. The problem when you get into World War II and or the late 30s even is that Henry Ford, he's my central figure, and I try to keep track of him, and he starts to lose his mind. I mean that he had a couple of nervous breakdowns, which I don't think too many people knew about. I found a testimony from his personal physician. He had a couple of nervous breakdowns. He was depressed. He withdrew into his big mansion on the River Rouge. He had a huge mansion where he lived with his wife, and he became very disenchanted with the company. His inner circle tried to get him to stop speaking out in public, because he never seemed to make sense. He would speak in non sequiturs, and he maybe even might have suffered from, I don't want to say Alzheimer's or something, but some form of dementia. And he maintained his grip on the company. until 1945. Nominally, I mean, in name he did, but he really wasn't running. In World War II, Henry Ford wasn't really running the company, at the helm of the company by that time. However, there is no question that, first of all, Ford was very heavily invested in the German economy from 1924 or 25, when they built their first plant over there in Cologne, Germany. It was 1924, like many other American companies. And I think that this is we're talking about neglected periods of history. I think that someone needs to take a look at the total investment of corporate America in Nazi Germany and try to sort out the proportions, because General Motors really had a much bigger chunk of the German car economy than Ford. And so it's not good enough to just say, well, they had a factory over there and Ford Motor Company was invested over there, because that doesn't single them out. Even saying they had slave labor in their factories, which was a fact that was brought to light in The Nation magazine about, I believe, almost 2 years ago, when some suits were brought against Ford by survivors of that period. So at that point in my story, Henry Ford is really not a player, but there's no question that the company was there. There's no question that it was run by, it was in fact run by sympathizers to the Nazis, in Germany, I mean. So I said to myself at that point, well, I can either write another 100 pages because it interests me, or I have to exercise my discipline as an author and maybe save it for another book, because once your protagonist is not a functional, then you don't want to, you know, prolong the agony. Do you know what I mean? It's fascinating.
We have just about 10 minutes left, and I have another caller.
So
No, that's fine. No, one of the great things about this program is that we can encourage some, lengthy responses. We don't have to tell people, well, you got to give us every response in a minute and a half. That's fine.
That's
we do also have another caller I'd like to bring into the conversation as well. Maybe I should also mention again, our guest is Neil Baldwin. If you'd like to read this, more of this story that we've been talking about, he's written a book on it. It's titled Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It's published by Public Affairs and is out now. Next caller is in Champaign here, line number one. Hello?
Is that me?
Yes.
Ah, hi. Well, this won't be all that long, but so far you've been talking about Ford in terms of his anti-Semitism as largely motivated around what sounds like an ethnic, cultural, and economic motivations. And I'm curious about Ford's, was he involved in Christian church?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up. I'm so glad this is.
Pardon me?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because, like I said at the beginning, this is a many-faceted problem. And I know we only have a few minutes, but I guess I would just turn your attention to, I have a whole section in my book about the British Israelite movement, which is something that's been written about in fragmented ways here and there. But the British Israelite movement basically was an Anglo-Saxon Christian sect that began in Canada and Britain sort of simultaneously. It was an English, in other words, it was an English roots. It had roots in the English culture. It believed that the Jews were not the chosen people, but that they were the usurpers of the Aryan race, the Anglo-Saxon race, who were the true chosen people of God. And the Anglo-Israelite movement took wing in America under the auspices of William Cameron, who, as I said earlier, was Ford's right-hand man and his main writer, writer under his own under Ford's byline. It would say by Henry Ford, but it was usually written by this man, Cameron, who was actually of Canadian birth. And there's no question that Cameron honed his ideology and had had a totally open and free platform to promulgate the British Israelite philosophy in the pages of the Dearborn Independent. Mm-hmm. And after he left formally, when they shut the newspaper down, Cameron founded the became the president of the Anglo-Israelites Society of America, mm-hmm. and he published the Protocols of the Elders of Zion under the auspices of the British Israelite movement in America. So I do show in the book how I think there's a connection between Ford's sort of as a spawning ground for a lot of the articulation of the Christian fundamentalist right-wing movement that came up in the late 30s, early 40s.
Was he, in fact, himself a churchgoer?
No, as a matter of fact, I couldn't put this in the book because it wasn't room, but there's a whole long oral history interview with the minister of Ford's church where he and his wife, Clara, was kind of like a ceremonial thing where they would have to make a showing and go to church. Uh-huh. But Ford was not an observant Christian, but I think he would be a kind of a lowercase c Christian. In other words, he believed that Christian meant American, Christian meant good people, white people, mm-hmm. hardworking people. So,
yeah,
what
I was curious about was whether or not there was a use of, it's been used, and quite easy to distort, actually, the Gospel of John and read it as an entirely anti-Semitic text.
Well, back in the beginning of the book, in the McGuffey Readers, there's excerpts from that very gospel.
Mm.
I don't like to speculate, and I could not point to a specific instance where Ford, he had the Bible, he kept the Bible in his home. He had a couch where he read at night by the fireplace there, and he had a well-thumbed copy of the Bible over there. He had Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson's writings there. There's no question he read, with his wife in the evening. She would read to him from the Bible and from the classics. But he just wasn't the kind of guy to make a literary allusion to anything. So, you don't want to take it too far. All you can show is, I tried to point out these elements in his intellectual life, but he was not a speech maker. He didn't really write anything himself, and so you have to be careful there.
Well, thanks very much. I'm really anxious to read your book. Thank you.
Right. Thanks for the call. We're coming to the point here where I'm sorry to say we only have maybe about 5 minutes or a little bit less, and there's a big part of the story that here we have not touched on because, as you said in the first part of the interview, that the book is not just about Henry Ford. It also looks at how the American Jewish community responded to Henry Ford. So maybe here you can take at least a couple of minutes to talk a little bit about that.
Well, I also would like to say, and I'm pretty proud of this, we did create a website. It's called neilbaldwinbooks.com, one word, neilbaldwinbooks.com. The reason I mention the website is because, for those of you who are interested, there's 3 or 4 chapters, from the book that you can read, and sort of it shows you pictures of all the different major characters and who they were, and it's kind of like an interesting sort of preview to help you get into the story. But in the visual part of the website are the pictures of the major Jewish leaders: Louis Marshall, Cyrus Adler, Aaron Shapiro, and Jacob Schiff, and the major Jewish leaders of the Jewish organizations that were founded, the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Congress, and the American Jewish Committee, that banded together to try to fight Ford's injustices. And I try to show in the book how they coped with that struggle, and it culminated in a libel suit brought in 1927 by a very prominent Jew named Aaron Shapiro, who was a community organizer who finally brought suit against Ford in Detroit and forced him to apologize for all the things he had done and said.
Mm.
And it's a very tragic story because, of course, Ford didn't really mean what he said. It was kind of an empty apology, but the Jewish community took it at its face value and was rejoicing for about 2 or 3 months until he began all over again, just began publishing and promoting his ideology.
One of the things that I wondered about, there was apparently concern within the Ford Motor Company that Mr. Ford's views and the fact that he was so vocal about them did have some effect on sales. Did people in the American Jewish community ever think about or talk about the possibility of an organized boycott?
Yes, they did talk about it. And there was a certain point, actually this was right about the time of the libel suit and the trial, which was a short-lived trial because Ford decided to come to terms with Shapiro because he didn't want to be dragged up to the witness stand. But anyway, just about the time of the trial, which got a lot of publicity, there was a meeting between Ford and his Northeast regional director from New York where it was reported to him that sales in the Northeast of America were way down. And at that point, I believe that was a precipitating factor in his apology. There was definitely an economic reaction. It wasn't organized. It wasn't like, you know, pamphlets were distributed. I don't believe it was a formal lobbying effort. I just think Jews stopped buying Fords in 1927.
Well, I think we're about at the point. I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop because we've used the time, but also want to tell the people, certainly if you're interested in reading this book that we've talked about, Henry Ford and the Jews, published by Public Affairs by our guest, Neil Baldwin, it is in the bookstore. And as he mentioned, also, if you have access to the internet, you can look at the website, Neil Baldwin Books, where there's some excerpts, there's more information, so you can get a sense of some of the material that the book contains. And also, if you're interested in some of the other people that Mr. Baldwin has written about, he's also done biographies of Thomas Edison, the American artist Man Ray, and the poet William Carlos Williams. You can look for those books as well. And Mr. Baldwin, to you, we want to say thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I really appreciate being on your show. And whatever my next book is, I hope I can come back.
Well, the invitation is wide open. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye now.